3 o'clock, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on Wednesday, the 5th of November, the year 2014. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk with Jenny Eckert, this week's Wildlife Wednesday speaker, about sea otters in southeast Alaska. We'll find out about First Friday Kindred Post. Brandon Howard, a ceramicist, will be here to highlight his First Friday show at the Canvas. Learn more about First Friday Theater's production of Chicago. James McCoviak will offer a preview of his Thursday presentation for the annual meeting of the Friends of Juneau Douglas Public City Museum. And Robert Bronin will be here to give us a preview of a presentation about the World Affairs Council. Will people in Alaska and South Pacific be forced to relocate? That renders Almanac, Burnout, Music, and More today on Juneau Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation election was held Tuesday, but voters did not choose a tribal president. In the primary, voters had picked now disqualified candidate Chris Deschini and Joe Shirley Jr. to face off in the general election. But challenges were made over Deschini's ability to speak Navajo fluently, a requirement for president. The issue has been playing out in court and tribal government. Deschini remained on the ballot, but voters for presidential candidates are not being counted. This morning, we spoke with Sunny Clotchis-Chilagi with the Navajo Times. She visited Navajo communities in Arizona and New Mexico on Election Day and says there was a grassroots group encouraging voters.
There was one specific tent that was kind of new, and people were just kind of walking by, and there was a banner that said, honor our vote, honor our votes count, things like that, and it was all part of this initiative called the Navajo Voters Rights Coalition. And apparently this coalition was started in October 28, just a couple days ago, by a man named Dusty Lee from Denahoso. And it's just a citizen who was just wanting to ensure that the voice of the Navajo people was being respected. The coalition has also created something called Freedom Ride, where Dene voters are standing up for their fundamental rights in each of the community. So there have been rallies throughout this election period, or the last couple of weeks even, or days, where these people as part of their coalition have been going to different communities and letting them know about their right to vote and to fight for that right. So this was new, definitely, at the camp. The biggest one was in Shiprock. They had their own setup there, just kind of giving people goodies and letting them know that, you know, stand up for your right to vote.
And so this sounds like it stems from the Navajo Nation presidential race, which did not happen yesterday.
My hometown community is Tisnaz Ponce, Arizona, and I kind of sat there and talked with people. And the big thing that came up was, it's crazy, it's confusing. And those were the big things. It wasn't necessarily anger. There are some places where people were very much open to talking about how angry they were that their votes were, in a sense, thrown out and that they didn't count. But for the most part, people were just confused because they didn't know what was going to happen next.
That was Sunny Clotchis-Chilagi with the Navajo Times. Tuesday's ballot included tribal council positions and other offices like school board. The Navajo Nation Election Office says unofficial results show voter turnout around 51%. There are nearly 115,000 registered voters. A special election for Navajo Nation president is scheduled for December. Edison Wanika is the Navajo Nation Election Administration Executive Director.
A lot of people were calling and saying that I'm not just going to vote. I think we all need to just participate in that election. I think we need to have our voice heard.
The presidential election is scheduled for December 23rd, but ongoing litigation could push back the election again. In other tribal election news, reports show incumbent President Brian Brewer was ousted by former President John Yellowbird Steele to lead the Oglala Sioux Tribe in South Dakota. In New Mexico, some Native voters are expressing disappointment that Deborah Holland was not elected lieutenant governor. Holland is a member of Laguna Pueblo. U.S. Senator Al Franken, who courted Native voters across Minnesota, won re-election. Franken sits on the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs and discussed tribal issues when he toured Minnesota tribes during campaign season. And unofficial results for a U.S. House race in Minnesota show Green Party candidate Skip Sandman, who's Ojibwe, received 4% of the vote. Join us tomorrow for updates on other races. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Science, technology, engineering, and math students thrive at New Mexico Tech. Personalized instruction, rigorous curricula, undergrad research opportunities. New Mexico Tech, where the smart kids go. Info in Winds of Change magazine or visit nmt.edu.
Program support by the Institute of American Indian Arts, offering the MFA in Creative Writing, featuring one-on-one mentorships with authors like Sherman Alexie, Natalie Diaz, and Joseph Boyden. More information available at iaia.edu/MFA.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:06 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Next guests are Patricia Weary and Ginny Eckert. We'll be talking about the Wildlife Wednesday presentation tonight at Thunder Mountain High School at 7 o'clock. Patricia is with the Alaska Wildlife Alliance, and Ginny is from the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Hello.
Hey, Jeff.
Thank you for coming today. So first of all, a little bit of information about the Alaska Wildlife Alliance, Patricia.
Well, this is the Southeast chapter that presents these Wildlife Wednesdays in town, and we're part of a state organization which is interested in the welfare and the continued welfare of creatures based on scientific information.
And Ginny, you're going to be talking about sea otters tonight.
Yep, that's correct.
Tell me something about sea otters that everybody doesn't know.
Ooh, that's tricky. Something that people don't know. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Well, sea otters can dive really deep for their food.
What is their food?
I'll be talking about their feeding habits tonight, and their diet consists primarily of marine invertebrates, crabs, clams, things like that.
What role do sea otters play in the Southeast Alaska ecosystem?
So sea otters are an important part of the ecosystem because they're an apex predator. That means they're the top predator. And one of the ways that they structure the ecosystem here is by eating sea urchins. And so places where you have sea otters, you have more kelp because the sea otters eat the urchins that eat kelp. And so the sea otters indirectly benefit the kelp. And then that leads to a greater diversity in the ecosystem because where you have kelp, then the kelp provides food for a whole diversity of things.
And how many are there and where are they located throughout Southeast Alaska?
So there's about 25,000 sea otters as of the last count in 2011. That number is somewhat dated now, and given the population growth rate, we probably have a lot more than that. The population growth rate varies a little bit in different parts of Southeast Alaska, but ranges from 4 to 13%. The sea otters are primarily distributed on the outer coast of Southeast Alaska, but their populations are expanding towards the inside waters.
It's a far cry from what it used to be in the 1700s.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know the exact number that used to be here. During the fur trade, throughout all of Southeast Alaska, the sea otters were exterminated. Some of the records indicate that maybe on the order of 100,000 animals were removed. That's just an approximate number.
How long does it take? How long do they live?
Sea otters can live up to 20 years, but somewhat varies. And in the wild, the males don't live as long as the females do. The males are pretty aggressive and fight with each other. So if they get a fatal injury, then they might live much shorter time period than that.
Why do they float on their back?
Yeah, that's a good question, Jeff. I don't really know why they float on their back, but one of the interesting things that they do is they dive down and collect their food, and they bring all their food up to the surface, and then they lie on their back, and you've probably heard stories of them using rocks to break open their food. So they lie on their back, and for example, if they're breaking open a clam, they'll take a rock and hit the clam with the rock to break it open and then eat the clam. So if you're lying on your belly, you'd have a pretty hard time eating a clam that way.
What portion of their life is spent looking for food and then just what other portion is just spent lying on their back having fun?
Well, that varies in different geographic areas. In Southeast Alaska, we think they have plenty of food. And in fact, I made an observation once of a sea otter who in 1.5 hours ate 6 geoduck clams, Gudeg clams can be on the average of 6 pounds each. So in an hour and a half, that sea otter probably got the food he needed for that day. Sea otters do consume a lot of food, roughly 25% of their body weight per day, but that sea otter certainly did that. In areas like California, where they're thought to be much more food limited, they will forage many, many more hours in the day.
What attracts you to sea otters?
Well, sea otters are fascinating creatures, and they're really important in the ecosystem. So I'm particularly interested in their role that they play in the ecosystem.
What role is that?
Well, you know, right now it's a very dynamic process. Their population is increasing at this very rapid rate, and the systems are changing as the sea otters expand into those areas. There's currently a competition with humans because sea otters like to eat a lot of the same things that we like to eat. So they like to go after Dungeness crab and sea cucumbers and other things that have commercial fisheries.
I don't want you to give away your whole lecture tonight, so I'm going to say thank you for coming by.
Stationary.
Ginny Eckert, she'll be talking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Thunderman High School. Patricia, is it the auditorium or the...
No, we're in the library.
In the library. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Oh, do come. Our goodies are so fine, and our speakers are better than our goodies.
Thanks for coming by.
Thanks.
Oh, sea otter, swimming on your back. Oh, sea otter, you really know how to relax. The water's cold along the coast, but your fur coat keeps you warm as toast. Oh, sea otter, swimming on your back. Born to swim in the ocean, you were born to splash and play. Oh, baby sea otter, stay with your mama all day. She'll feed you and she'll take good care. She'll even wash and dry your hair. Baby sea otter, stay with your mama all day. Oh, sea otter, swimming on your back. Oh, sea otter, you really know how to relax. The water's cold along the coast, but your fur coat keeps you warm as toast. Oh, sea otter, swimming on your back.
Long. Clams and mussels, abalone, the list goes on and on. You eat until your belly's full and you lay back in your great big pool. Little sea otter, eating all day long.
Oh, sea otter, your home is in the waves. Diving, rolling, doing the backstroke, splashing all day. Oh, sea otter, the tide rolls out and in. And you just lay there floating along with your great big otter grin. Oh, sea otter, swimming on your back. Oh, sea otter, you really know how to relax. The water's cold along the coast, but your fur coat keeps you warm as toast. Oh, sea otter, swimming on your back. Little sea otter, how big and strong you've grown. Now it's time to leave your mama and strike out on your own. You'll dive beneath the ocean swell, 'cause your mama taught you oh so well. Little sea otter, how big and strong you've grown. Oh, sea otter, swimming on your back. Oh, sea otter, you really know how to relax. The water's cold along the coast, but your fur coat keeps you warm as toast. Oh, sea otter, swimming on your back. The water's cold along the coast, but your fur coat keeps you warm as toast. Oh, sea otter, swimming on your back.
Time is 3:14, and you are tuned in to KTOO News in Juneau on a Juneau afternoon. Next guests are Kelsey Lovig, Ariel Rolfe, and Connor Lindham here to talk about what's going on this first Friday at the Kindred Post. Thanks for coming down, everybody.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jeff.
Who wants to go first?
I'll go first, I think. You know, as the host of where it'll be. So for the first Friday at Kindred Post, we're going to have Ariel Rolf and Kelsey Lovig setting up our photo booth this month. Every month, instead of hanging art from different artists in the gallery, we set up a photo booth. And we have different local photographers come and choose whatever theme they'd like. Last month, we had DJ Derego do a superhero comic book theme, which was a lot of fun. We made a backdrop, said like Kindred Comics. And this month, Ariel, what is the theme that you two have picked out to help entertain and integrate Juno's local Junoites into the art that they're going to come see?
So Kelsey and I came up with this idea that we're calling Mealtime Antics. And it all comes from family dinners and group dinners, and I have a lot of dinners with friends. And I feel like the best and most entertaining things in life come out over family meals or meals with groups of friends. And so we're kind of wanting to bring Juno community in and get all of your friends and family together and stage a photo, because you don't always capture those moments. So we've been working on all sorts of food and animals and things to bring to the photo booth, and we'll be setting up a dinner with place settings and
lots of props.
Yep, lots of props, and people can come and rearrange them however they want and reenact their family dinners at home and have a lot of fun with it.
Or reenact the family dinners they always wish they'd had.
Right.
This photo booth, is it the type of photo booth that I remember from growing up where we get four poses for $1 or something?
Well, it's all free. We have a digital camera set up on a tripod, and so we'll just have a little area of the store kind of cordoned off, and we'll take a photo with the digital camera. And then we'll post it online so that everybody can see themselves, and if they want to make prints, they can do it from that.
Sounds like a novel idea. Who came up with the idea?
The
proprietor, Christy Erickson of Kinder Post, came up with the idea of featuring different local photographers and setting up a photo booth every month instead of hanging like a gallery, because it was a way to incorporate ourselves into that really fun and exciting like First Friday experience of like being part of like the Juno art culture on like that monthly basis without having to commit like wall space to having it be like a gallery, because that's, while we do treat our business very much like a gallery and focus a lot of independent artists, like people making these different things, it's not quite the same as like hanging paintings and having people come and look at them and walk through. It very much is a gift shop as well as a contract postal station. But with this way, like people get to come and they get to experience that First Friday feeling while also becoming a part of the thing they're coming to experience. Because, like, you know, you get to come, you get to, like, make these fun, like, sometimes silly, sometimes gorgeous, like, photos of themselves, like, with their friends and the people they care about for free and for a good time. And it's not just that. We also, every First Friday, we've got live music. And this month we are featuring Cats and Kites. And we're going to be open for the First Friday portion from 4:30 to 7. And we'll be providing some snacks and some refreshments as well.
This is like a lot of fun. It's all happening at the Kindred Post. Tell me, and the listeners out there, where the Kindred Post is.
Kindred Post is at 145 South Franklin. It's where Miners Postal used to be. It's just across the street from the Triangle Club and from Hearthside Books.
Kelsey Lovick, Ariel Rolf, and Connor Lindrum, anything you'd like to add on? I forgot to ask.
I think it's 4:30 to 7:30, and it's on Friday. And so come on down. Bring everybody you know, everybody you don't know. All groups are welcome.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 5th of November, 2014. The day observed with bonfires in the UK. As it says in the rhyme, remember, remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder treason and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot. It's Guy Fawkes Day, and across Britain, people may light bonfires to remember the day in 1605 when the gunpowder plot was broken up. It was in the time of King James I when Catholics were persecuted in England, and so a group of Catholics hatched a plot to blow up the Houses of Parliament and kill the king. 36 barrels of gunpowder in a cellar underneath the House of Lords, and it was guarded by a man named Guy Fawkes when the king's men stormed in and arrested him. It was on this day, 1930, a Swedish newspaper reporter telephoned the novelist Sinclair Lewis to tell him that he had won the Nobel Prize in Literature. Lewis at first thought it was a joke, but in fact he was the first American to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. He told a friend at the time, "This is the end of me. I cannot live up to it." And he used his Nobel lecture to talk about all the other writers who might have been chosen, Dreiser and Eugene O'Neill, Willa Cather, Hemingway, Faulkner. It's the birthday of Ida Tarbell, born Hatch Hollow, Pennsylvania, 1857. She was working for McClure's magazine when she was assigned to write an expose of Standard Oil and John D. Rockefeller. She spent 2 years investigating and got evidence that Standard Oil was colluding with railroad companies to drive smaller refineries out of business. The articles were collected into a book, and the federal government began antitrust prosecution, and the breakup of the company was finally decided by the Supreme Court in 1911, a major American corporation brought down by a journalist. And it's the birthday of historian Will Durant, born in North Adams, Massachusetts, 1885, who wrote an 11-volume history of the human race, The Story of Civilization, offered for sale by the Book of the Month Club for $29.95. It sold more than 500,000 copies. Here's a poem for today by Katha Pollitt, a poem with a word in the last line, sighing, which is not S-I-G-H-I-N-G, but which is S-C-Y-T-H-I-N-G. Katha Pollitt's poem, November 5th, Riverside Drive. The sky, a shock, the ginkgos, yellow fever, I wear the day out, walking, November, and still light stuns the big bay windows on West End Avenue. The park brims over with light like a bowl, and on the river a sailboat quivers like a white leaf in the wind. How like an 18th century painting, this year's decorous decline. The sun still warms the aging marble porticos and scrolled pavilions, past which an old man, black-coated apparition of Voltaire, flaps on his constitutional. Clear air, clear mind, as if he could outpace darkness, sighing home like a flock of crows. Katha Pollitt's poem, November 5th, Riverside Drive, from Antarctic Traveler, published by Alfred A. Knopf and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Programming support on KTOO is provided by Silver Bow Bakery and Catering, announcing ready-to-serve Thanksgiving meals for 8 to 12 people or half orders serving 4 to 6. Ready for pickup and eat Thanksgiving Day. Silver Bow Catering, accepting Thanksgiving orders at 586-4146.
Time is 3:23 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau on a Juneau afternoon. Next guest is Brandon Howard. He's got a First Friday show at the Canvas coming up. Brandon, thank you very much for coming down to the station.
Hey, thanks for having me here, Jeff.
So you've been working on ceramics for about 6 years.
Yeah.
What attracted you to them?
You know, it's the utility of it. I like getting to build things and make things for use to solve problems. And so it was my way of making the things that I eat from, the things that I drink from, storage containers, making them the way I wanted them to be.
What kind of problems does Bay Ceramicist solve?
Oh, nothing major, you know. Need a jar for something, want a plate to eat off of. No big problems are solved with clay.
What are your favorite techniques?
You know, lately I've been really enjoying working with porcelain and these water slide decals. They're like decals that people who make model airplanes and, you know, the old model airplane decals. I print them out in a printer that I've got at the studio. And old laser printers have iron oxide, which is a glaze ingredient, in the toner. And so when you fire them onto the plate, it ends up becoming a glaze. And so I like to work with patterns and different imagery and applying those to the surfaces of my pots.
Pots are what you make mostly? Do you make ashtrays? And
yeah, you know, I think it's like pottery jargon or lingo. Everything they make, they call a pot. So, you know, when I say pot, I'm generically referring to plates and bowls, anything made out of clay.
You've been teaching at the Canvas for a number of months now. What do you learn from teaching?
You know, I've been at the Canvas now for just over 2 years, and teaching is incredible because it makes you really think about what you are doing, because you have to communicate the skill that you have. So I have to be able to communicate to people very clearly what I'm doing so that it makes sense to them. Because for me, it's something that now feels comfortable, and it's not, I'm not going to say it's second nature or that it's easy. It's still really hard for me, but, you know, it's something that when I sit down at the wheel, I don't actively think of every little thing that I'm doing. But to have somebody succeed with clay, you need to be able to think about every little thing that you're doing and communicate that. And so by thinking about those things, by thinking about my process, I get to really refine it. And so my skills have improved just from thinking about what I'm doing and teaching others.
So you're a wheel man rather than a slab fellow?
You know, I am kind of... I think I've pigeonholed myself into the wheel. I love getting to make pinch pots, and I like getting the slab build. But I'm much more competent at the wheel than I am hand building. So I end up working at the wheel, building functional things more often than hand building or working with slabs.
The little clay work I've done, it's very tactile.
It is. It's very tactile. It's very satisfying. The textures are great. And then working at the wheel is, I think, I would say 90% of my students comment on how relaxing it is. It's like therapeutic to sit and watch the wheel spin and work with the clay. So,
I'm talking with Brandon Howard. He's a ceramicist. He's got a show of ceramic pots and et cetera items. Showing the first Friday at the Canvas. What kind of things are we liable to see at this Friday?
At this show, I've focused on plates and really working with surfaces. Over the past couple of years, I've been lucky enough to showed at the Canvas. I've gotten to show my work at Copa and Annie Kales and. And I've explored all these different surfaces and all these different ideas, and I've wanted to revisit a lot of them. And with this show, I kind of gave myself permission to take all these different things I've been doing and combine them and rework them. And it's been a really, really fun process, and it's been great to work with old familiar surfaces and materials, and then blend them with the new things I've been doing and kind of see what direction it goes in. So if you come down, it's a lot of plates and some bigger platters and large bowls. But the surfaces are what I've really paid attention to with this show.
And we talked a little bit before the interview on the air, and you don't just slap a little glaze on everything.
No. So I've, with the pots that I make, I like to leave some of the clay body bare. I work with a porcelain that I love. I sand it down and it gets a really glassy, smooth feel, and it's a beautiful white. And then I like to layer it with glazes in some spots. I've been working with a lot of really bright colors that I'll paint onto the clay while it's still wet, and then I'll carve away from the bright colors so you see that white porcelain underneath, and then I'll layer glaze over that, layer some of the decals I was talking to you about. I'll layer the decals over all of it and then put some luster in spots. And so a lot of the pieces have gone through a kiln firing 4 times before they're hanging up on the walls.
Brandon Howard, thanks so much for coming down to the station today. Your show opens up this Friday about 4:30 at the campus, which is located at the corner of 3rd and Seward Street. Anything you'd like to add, I might have forgotten to ask.
No, you covered it all. Thanks so much for having me on.
This is Bird Note. What great spectacle would draw a steady stream of birders this time of year to a place well known for being hot and smelly? California's below sea level Salton Sea and the irrigated farmlands at its southern end are a mecca for tens of thousands of wintering birds. This inland sea formed when the Colorado River breached floodgates in 1905. Water flowed into the arid Imperial Valley, forming a lake 45 miles long. A century later, the lake has diminished in size and greatly increased in salt concentration, becoming too salty for most aquatic life. But a single introduced fish persists in abundance, the African tilapia. Seabirds, including thousands of brown pelicans, visit the Salton Sea to gobble its fish. The smell comes from occasional massive die-offs of the fish, so abundant that their bones make up the shoreline. Every winter, the salty waters support hordes of water birds, including shorebirds, herons, cormorants, and waterfowl. Great flocks of snow and Ross's geese feed in the farmlands. A cloud of these white birds lifting from a field may make you forget the heat and even the smell. Check out the photos at birdnote.org. Today's show is brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation.
Support for a Juno Afternoon comes from BEP Company, providing remanufacturing and recycling services for toner and inkjet print cartridges. Serving Juno for 25 years. More information at bepcompany.com or 789-2230.
I hate when that happens.
Time is 3:32 and you are tuned in to KTO News in Juno, and I've got a couple of people involved with the Chicago Production and Perseverance Theater in the studio.
Hey, Jeff.
Colette Costa and Shana Strasser.
None of this is my fault. I want everybody to know.
Thanks for having us.
So, Shana, you're the director of this play.
Totally. This thing is being so directed. It's a huge project. There's 21 actors on stage.
Really?
Yeah. There's 21 actors.
No wonder I can't get any space.
There's 6 musicians. There's a design team of 6. It's a big production.
And just like practicing, oh my gosh. You can't believe how much they practice, Jeff. It's annoying. I mean, honestly, how much do you have to go over this to get it done? Get on, say something, get off again. Pick up the stuff you brought with you. It's unbelievable what goes on over there. I mean, I just never realized. If I had known, I'd have opted out of this a long time ago. I'm exhausted. I haven't even done anything yet.
What do you do when you're on stage?
As little as I can imagine. And everything, I'm like, can I be sitting in this one? Can I get? Thank God they put poles and I have something to lean against. If I'm not leaning or sitting, I'm just tired. I have a part. I have lines, and occasionally I remember them when I say them correctly.
You remember them.
And then I still say them wrong.
I know, but it's actually waiting for just the lines. The gist of the lines is highly entertaining.
I like to say that I play Queen Latifah.
Yes.
She has a very small role in this play.
Take Mike a big woman to fill a small role, Jeff.
Amen.
And yet I take up so much space.
So, Shauna, what is the play about?
Well, it's the musical is, it came out in a movie when it was like 2006 or something like that, 2005. But it essentially follows these two murderesses, Velma Kelly and Roxy Hart. And these murderesses are, they have killed their husbands. And
Partners.
Sisters. And one of them killed their sister, too. And they're in jail now. And Colette plays Mama Matron, Morton. And she is the kind of keeper of all the ladies in the prison. And that's at Cook County Jail in Chicago. And so it basically follows 1920s Chicago and what's going on with the vaudeville movement. And this piece of theater, this musical, is definitely a nod to, I mean, it's all vaudeville pieces. So it's pretty great that way.
And this is the longest running show on Broadway.
The longest running American show on Broadway. So Phantom of the Opera is actually the longest running on Broadway, but that is so very British. So we don't count that one.
She can say that because her mom's British.
That's right.
Any pressure?
Which kind?
Other than just getting the play produced, it's like you've got big shoes to fill.
Yeah, it's a big old Broadway production, and what I really love about our production is that, sure, it definitely says, okay, yeah, there's these Broadway elements and things, but, we have all the Fosse choreography, and we have all the songs, and, we haven't taken any of the songs out, and I've noticed on Broadway sometimes they cut a song here and there, but we've been very true to the script. And the actual script, the play was written in the 1920s and actually 1926. And the musical that was made in 1975 was based on that play. So we've gone back to the 20s. We're way going back. So you see on Broadway, you'll see like all the women wearing really next to nothing, like dance clothes, and that's kind of it. And not really any kind of nod to the era. Really, but mostly to the choreography and to the storyline being very thin. Our storyline is popping out a little bit more, and we're all in 1920s, so it looks beautiful. The designs are amazing.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, for a designer.
If you're into that kind of thing.
Opens up when?
It opens Friday. We have a pay-as-you-can preview this evening. It's our last preview. And then we open on Friday, and we run for 5 weekends. There was also just an additional show added. An extra pay-as-you-can was added a couple days ago on Wednesday, November 12th. It's in your calendar. Don't worry.
We are going to discuss this later.
It's an over 21 event, and Salt will be providing the bar for that. So we'll card everybody at the door.
Oh, that's okay then.
Turn it into a little speakeasy for the evening.
Nice.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. I'm going to go to that show too.
All right, I'm in that one.
I haven't seen you in a play that much. Is this your first play?
Here in at Perseverance, yes. Here in town, yes. Here in Alaska, yes. How much farther we got to go?
Earth.
Here on the planet, no. No. But we don't talk about what happened before. That was the other side of the coin, Jeff.
You're clever.
I'm actually technically legally not allowed to talk about it. The restraining orders and all. But believe you me, mister, I got experience.
What's it like having you're the queen of the impromptu.
It's true, yeah. And now we're like rehearsing all the time. How is that?
It's so it's difficult. It's very difficult.
But I think you'll do a good job at it.
Oh, well, she's amazing.
The trick, the trick is honestly just finding a more interesting way to do the same thing. I mean, as a singer, you often are asked to sing the same song over and over and over again. And as much as you love that song, you can get sick of it. But if you can find a new way to do it, a different way to say what you're saying, and of course, you're also playing off of other people and essentially trying not to fall down or, you know, embarrass yourself in another way. So that's really what's more on my mind. And also, I have all my lines written on my hands. So
they look like tattoos.
A lot of hand fanning in front of my face.
Colette Costa and Shona Strasser, thank you for coming down to the station. Opens up again when?
It opens Friday, November 7th. You can get tickets at perseverancetheater.org or by calling 463-TIXS.
Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Come check it out. It's a rip-roaring good time. I just said rip-roaring.
Yeah. Please don't clap along. Now they're all going to do that.
Yeah, totally.
Please clap along. Wait a minute. That doesn't work either.
Please sing along.
Sing alone?
Perfect.
Yeah. 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 Please, just don't throw things at me in particular. It would be appreciated.
Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Jeff.
It's 3:41, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Next guests are Jim Makoviak and Mike Blackwell. Mike's with the organization Friends of the Juneau Douglas City Museum. Jim is a book author who's written several books. The most recent one is Alaska Salmon Traps. Thank you very much for coming to the station, everybody.
Thank you. Thanks.
So, Mike, you want to talk about the Friends of the City Museum?
Yes, Friends of the Juneau Douglas City Museum.
Excuse me.
We are a nonprofit, and we do whatever we can do to support all activities of the museum.
And you have your annual meeting coming up Thursday.
We have our annual meeting tomorrow at 7 o'clock at the Hangar Ballroom. There will be a very brief, mercifully brief business meeting, and then the centerpiece of the evening will be a discussion by Jim, one of Gus Davis's premier scholars, about his recent book on fish traps.
Thank you, Mike.
And we'll also talk a little bit about the work of the Friends of the Museum, what we're doing, and what we're going to be doing. The event is free.
How much does it cost to be a member of the Friends?
It's a sliding scale. I believe the entry level is, that's a moment here, let me check. Well, I think it's $50. You get a premium if you join at $75. A box of Dale DeArmond note cards, and you get a free book by Jim if you join at the $150 patron level.
Just like public radio.
Just like public radio. We're learning a lot from you.
Jim, you got a book called Alaska Salmon Traps. It's a must-read for students of Alaska history. I've seen you talk about it before a couple of times, and I'm just fascinated by your mastery of the knowledge of the subject.
Yeah, it's pretty obscure in a lot of ways because traps aren't utilized anymore, but it's a big part of Alaska's history, and I think an interesting part.
Describe a typical salmon trap.
Well, there were really two kinds of traps. One were pile traps, which were piles, logs that were placed vertically in the water, and the netting was hung between them. And then it was configured such that it funneled traps, funneled fish into a holding area from which they could be held for several days at least, and used by the cannery whenever they needed them. I mean, that was one of the nice things about salmon traps, is it was live inventory. In water that was too deep to drive piles, floating traps were used. And these were invented in southeast Alaska in 1907. And these traps used big Sitka spruce logs, and the webbing was hung from there. And again, configured just about like a pile trap, but they were held in place by a lead that ran to shore and had a net on it. And then the trap on the outside was anchored. And the anchors... you know, it could be very large. I mean, 9,000 pounds. And if I could add right now about anchors, I think they're pretty neat items. Once the fish trap era ended, the last traps were utilized in southeast Alaska, generally in 1958. There were a lot of trap anchors on the beaches because these traps were stored during the winter, and they just put the trap anchors on the beaches. The timber industry took them to anchor. That was when the pulp mills were starting. The timber industry took them to anchor their log rafts. But there's still a few around, even on beaches, if you know where to look. And there's a few in town here. There's the city I saw had a couple of big mushroom anchors. They weigh about 9,000 pounds each, and they were being utilized to anchor a barge out at Auk Bay. And I always thought that, boy, those would be great yard ornaments for, like, the State Museum or the city Juneau City Douglas Museum.
It's clear their importance is Alaska and also the desire for statehood.
I think the importance was more to the canning industry. You know, they denied fishermen a lot of opportunities to fish. I mean, the traps were owned mostly by the canneries. They controlled the supply of fish. They controlled the canning of fish. They controlled everything, which was great for them. But Alaskans resented this. And what it did was, you know, we want to be able to control our fisheries. Alaskans wanted to be able to control them. And the federal government was pretty much going along with the industry and supporting the fish trap idea there. It wasn't really a conservation issue because the traps could be closed or opened, you know, if there weren't enough fish and there were some mandates there. But it was denying Alaskans an opportunity to earn a living, you know, from the sea. And, you know, the resentment was there. And, you know, by becoming a state, Alaskans figured that they could control the waters and eliminate the fish traps. And in 1948, there was a referendum, territory-wide referendum held on banning fish traps. And 8-1, Alaskans favored banning the traps.
Fish pirates.
They weren't the swashbuckling type that sometimes are portrayed here. I mean, there were a few people who did end up in prison, but most of the fish piracy that was going on was actually fishermen coming in hand in hand or hat in hand and talking to a trap watchman at night saying, okay, you know, can I have a load of fish? And they might pay the watchman, you know, $50 and a bottle of whiskey or something like that and load the boat up. But a few people did end up in jail. I think there were a few shots fired. I don't remember anybody ever being wounded or anything like that. But it was kind of a badge of honor. It wasn't exactly Robin Hood, where you're robbing from the rich to give to the poor, but you're basically robbing from the rich cannery owners and enriching yourself. But since they were bad guys anyway, it was an honorable occupation.
How many fish traps were there in southeast Alaska?
The number of traps territory-wide peaked in 1926. There were 799. In southeast Alaska, was very heavily trapped in Icy Strait, west of Juneau here. It's a major corridor for fish traveling into northern southeast Alaska, and it was probably the most heavily trapped area in Alaska. At one point, between Point Coverdon and Excursion Inlet, there were 22 traps. I mean, that's a lot of traps. Some of these traps were killer traps. Those are ones that are really designed to catch fish. Other ones, they called them dummy traps, and they were just taking up space so that your neighbor wouldn't put a trap in there and intercept your fish. I don't really have the number right here on how many traps there were in southeast Alaska. I come tomorrow night, and I'll have the number for you.
All right. I've been talking to Jim McCoviak and Mike Blackwell about tomorrow night's presentation. It's the annual meeting of the Friends of the Juneau Douglas City Museum. Starts at 7 o'clock?
7 o'clock. Hangar
on the Wharf Ballroom.
If you want to know a little bit more, go to the lecture tomorrow night. If you want to know a lot more, buy a copy of Jim's book.
Thank you, Jeff.
Free refreshments.
Time is 3:51. You are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guests are Joanne Bloom and Robin Brunnen. They're here to talk about what's going on tonight for the Juneau World Affairs Council. The speech is called, Will People in Alaska and the South Pacific Be Forced to Relocate? The Human Rights Implications of Climate Change and Population Displacement, with Robin Brunnen. Robin and Joanne, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you.
So, Robin, your title is the Senior Research Scientist at the University at the Institute of Arctic Biology, located at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. How serious is the problem about moving out of town?
So the issue of population displacement caused by climate change is going to be one of the most severe consequences of climate change, based on reports done by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And here in Alaska, that displacement is happening more intensely than other parts of the world because the Arctic is warming at 2 to 3 times the rate of the warming that's happening in the lower latitudes.
How serious is the problem? And I should say, how close is it looming in our future?
Well, it's happening now. There are several communities in western Alaska that are in the process of trying to relocate. And in the South Pacific, there are several communities that are also in the process of relocating. And the focus of my research has been on the fact that we do not have the governance institutions in place to address the problem, and there are huge human rights implications because of the displacement that is happening and will happen because of sea level rise, erosion, repeated extreme weather events, drought, all of these things that are happening now but are going to happen more intensely as the climate continues to warm.
What can be done about it? Just moving?
Well, we need to reduce our emissions. We, based on the synthesis report that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change just released about 3 days ago, we don't have very much time to significantly reduce our carbon emissions. Because if we don't, right now we're projected to have a 2 degrees Celsius increase, and we could be on track for a 4 or more degrees Celsius increase globally. Here in Alaska, we're looking at 8 to 9 degrees Celsius increase by the end of the century.
It's not something we haven't heard before, but it's still shocking.
It is shocking. I have a hard time really digesting the fact that that's what the modeling is showing here for Alaska.
How easy is it to reduce this fossil fuel emissions?
Well, it's up to each one of us individually, of course, and then our government leaders need to create systemic change in regard to the reduction of carbon emissions. We need nationally, we need a plan, and then internationally, we need an agreement so that carbon reductions globally are reduced significantly.
Joanne, do you want to talk a little bit about the Juneau World Affairs Council, please?
Sure, yeah. We're really excited to sponsor Robin to come down here and talk to us about this important issue. The Juneau World Affairs Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan membership organization. Our goal is to encourage dialogue and understanding of important international economic, political, and social issues. And we just finished up a forum on Mexico that was very successful. We're looking forward to having another speaker a week from today. That'll be Will Dobson. He's going to be speaking on Are Dictators Getting Smarter? The Battle Between Dictatorships and Democracy. So that's another good one coming up. We have another speaker coming in December, and it's not too early to mark your calendars for our annual Fun World Quest event. That's going to be happening on February 6th of 2015.
I keep thinking about the South Pacific Islands, and there's really no place for them to go. In Alaska, we could just move closer and closer to Mount Denali.
Well, there's no place for a lot of the communities in Western Alaska to go because permafrost is thawing. So while when people look at the map of our state and they see a lot of land and not a lot of human settlements, people think, wow, there's all this land where people can move to. But the fact is permafrost is thawing dramatically. And it's not now suitable for human settlements without huge expense in regard to the infrastructure that would need to be developed. And we don't know how much the permafrost is going to continue to thaw as our temperatures continue to rise.
Where do you put all the South Pacific Islanders?
Well, so what you're talking about are the places in the South Pacific where nation states, the entire nation state, is on coral atolls, like the Marshall Islands, Kiribati, Tuvalu, and the implications for nation state governments is exponentially more intense because there are issues of sovereignty and territoriality that have not been addressed, and why people are adamant about being able to stay where they are.
It doesn't sound very realistic looking at the facts.
Well, when you're really deeply connected to the land on which you live, the thought that you may be forced to leave it and never go home is a really hard thing to digest because of the consequences of all of our actions using carbon emissions.
Robin, we'll be talking tonight in front of the Juneau World Affairs Council meeting. It starts at 5 o'clock.
That's right, Jeff. It's 5 o'clock, and it's right here at the K2 Studios. It'll be at 360 North, and it will be televised for broadcast later on 360 North. So we hope a lot of people come down to hear Robin Bronin speak this evening at 5.
Robin, Joanne, anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Well, people can always go to jwac.org and find out what's happening. And better yet, they can click on the email list, and they can get an email about once or twice a week to find out who will be coming to speak with us next.
All right, thanks very much for coming to the station today.
Thank you.
Time is 3:58, and you are tuned to KTMO News in Juneau. With a forecast for tonight, there's a high wind warning to midnight tonight. Forecast for the parts of tonight, cloudy skies with isolated rain showers, high temperatures 44 to 50 degrees. Tomorrow at 3 on a June afternoon, Shona Strasser will be your host. She'll talk with Deb Garnberg about the early onset mental illness, this month's Inside Passages topic. We'll meet Troy Quinn, one of the Juneau Symphony's guest conductors. Beth Weigel will be here to give us an update of library activities. We'll meet two artists in town for workshops in comic art and the business of being an artist. We'll hear about local arts activities with our regular feature Arts Help.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable, on digital channel 87.